Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we pull back the curtain on fascinating, sometimes unexpected, corners of knowledge. Today, we're venturing into the world of antitrust law. But our point of entry might surprise you. It's, well, a bowl of macaroni. We're diving into the 1965 case of National Macaroni Manufacturers Association v. FTC.
That's right. And it might sound like, a quirky historical footnote, but this case actually reveals a really fundamental principle of antitrust law.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How even seemingly innocuous agreements, like around product standards, can actually be seen as illegal collusion. It's a great example of how the law looks beyond just the surface level.
Exactly. I mean, when you picture a landmark legal battle, macaroni probably isn't the first thing that springs to mind, right?
Not typically, no.
But this case has a surprising core. It all boils down to a decision made by pasta companies about the type of wheat they were using in their products. And here's where it gets really interesting.
So our mission, sort of in this deep dive, is to understand why the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, actually took action against this association of macaroni manufacturers.
Right.
All for agreeing to something that sounds pretty simple. Using a 50-50 blend of durum wheat, that's where semolina comes from, and a cheaper wheat called farina. What was so problematic about that seemingly practical decision?
Okay, let's unpack this. We need to meet the key player here. The National Macaroni Manufacturers Association, or NMMA. Now, this wasn't a small group.
No, not at all.
They represented a really significant majority of the industry, like 84 out of the 125 major macaroni producers in the U.S. And together, they controlled a whopping 70% of the entire macaroni market.
Why?
That kind of market share is it's a big piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely. I mean, when you have that level of control, even your internal agreements can have pretty wide-ranging market effects, Now, what kicked all of this off, it wasn't just a sudden whim to change the pasta recipe, right? There was a specific context.
You're right. There were shortages of durum wheat in both 1953 and again in 1961. Now, durum wheat, that's the premium ingredient.
Right, the good stuff.
The one that gets milled into semolina and gives macaroni its firm, characteristic texture. You could think of it as the high-quality flour of the pasta world. These shortages created a real headache for the producers trying to keep up with demand.
Okay, so facing these shortages of their key ingredient, the NMNA and its members, they came up with a solution. It seemed, on the face of it, like a sensible way to stretch their limited supply and, maintain production.
Their answer was to agree to standardize their macaroni production across the board. Basically, they decided that all their members would use a blend, 50% durum wheat, that's the semolina we talked about, and 50% farina, which is a much cheaper, less desirable wheat in terms of final pasta quality, kind of the budget option.
Okay.
It sounds like a practical compromise to keep pasta on the shelves, doesn't it?
Well, that's certainly how the manufacturers might have presented it. But the FTC, they looked beyond that surface explanation. They alleged that the real intention behind this agreement wasn't just about adapting to a temporary shortage. They suspected something much more fundamentally anti-competitive was at play.
So what was the FTC's suspicion then? What did they believe was the underlying motive for this seemingly reasonable 50-50 blend agreement? Were they just being cynical?
Well, the FTC's accusation was quite serious. They believed the manufacturers were trying to intentionally depress the price of durum wheat. By collectively agreeing to drastically reduce the amount of durum wheat they needed in their production, they were effectively shrinking the overall demand for it. And, basic economics tells us that reduced demand usually leads to lower prices.
Right, allowing the macaroni makers to cut their ingredient costs.
Exactly.
Ah, I see. So it wasn't just about managing a temporary scarcity. It was potentially about manipulating the market for their primary ingredient to save money long term. That's a very different ballgame.
It is.
It sounds like these pasta makers were essentially accused of, like, playing the stock market with wheat. That's wild.
Precisely. The FTC argued that this was a way for these dominant manufacturers, remember they control 70% of the market, to unfairly lower their production costs. And this came at the direct expense of the durum wheat farmers. Plus, it could also put smaller macaroni producers, the ones who weren't part of this agreement, and might still be trying to use more of the expensive, higher quality durum wheat at a significant competitive disadvantage.
Okay, the pot is definitely stirring now. You have a major industry association, wheat shortages, a standardized product blend agreement, and the FTC suspecting some foul play or maybe some undercooked dealings.
Right.
So what was the central legal question that arose from all of this? What was the FTC actually accusing them of violating?
Okay, so the core legal issue was whether this agreement by the NMMA to standardize the composition of macaroni constituted an illegal restraint of trade. Specifically, did it violate Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act?
Section 5.
Okay. Yeah, this act is pretty broad. It prohibits unfair methods of competition in commerce. It's really a key piece of legislation for maintaining, you know, a level playing field in business.
And what did the courts decide? Did the National Macaroni Manufacturers Association successfully argue their case, or did the FTC's arguments convince the judges?
Well, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals ultimately sided firmly with the FTC. They upheld the FTC's decision.
They did.
Yeah. They agreed that the NMMA's agreement to standardize their product using this 50-50 blend was indeed an anti-competitive practice. So the FTC won this round.
So the FTC's cease and desist order against the NMMA was upheld. That meant they were legally prohibited from continuing this 50-50 blend agreement as a collective industry standard. They couldn't all just agree to make their macaroni the same way with this specific ratio, not for the purpose they were accused of anyway.
Exactly. And to really understand why the court reached this seemingly surprising conclusion, I mean, that agreeing on a recipe could be illegal. We need to dig into the legal reasoning and some really key antitrust concepts. This is where it gets really interesting, especially for, you know, anyone studying business law.
Okay, unpack this for us. The big question that likely jumps out is, how does agreeing on a recipe, on the ingredients, become a form of price fixing? Like you said, they weren't directly saying all macaroni must be sold at X price. It seems kind of a step removed.
That's a critical point, and it really highlights the sophistication sometimes of antitrust law. The court's reasoning heavily relied on something called the per se rule.
Per se, okay.
Think of it like a no questions asked foul in basketball. Certain agreements among competitors are considered so inherently damaging to competition that they are automatically illegal, per se illegal, without needing a lengthy investigation into their actual market impact or reasonableness.
Okay.
Direct price fixing, like competitors getting together and agreeing on what price to charge, that's the classic example of a per se violation.
So even though the NMMA wasn't explicitly setting the final price of macaroni on the grocery store shelves, their collective action on the ingredient side was still seen as a form of price manipulation. Is that it?
Precisely. The court recognized that even indirect actions can have a very direct and significant impact on prices. By agreeing to collectively slash their demand for durum wheat, that premium ingredient, the NMMA, artificially depressed the demand for it.
Right.
And as we discussed earlier, lower demand inevitably tends to lead to lower prices. So while they weren't dictating the price of the finished pasta, they were manipulating the price of a fundamental raw material. The court viewed that as a form of anti-competitive behavior aimed at lowering their own costs.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. Artificially lowering your input costs gives you an unfair competitive advantage. And when a massive group of producers does it together, like 70% of the market, it can really warp the entire market for that input. But this brings up another important point. Does this mean all industry-wide product standards are now illegal? What about things like, say, safety standards for cars or electrical appliances, where everyone agrees on a minimum level of quality or safety?
That's a very insightful question, and the court in this case was careful to draw that distinction. Not all product standardization is illegal, not by a long shot.
Okay.
In many instances, standardization can actually be beneficial for consumers. And the industry, think about ensuring interoperability of technology, like, you know, universal charging cables or establishing minimum safety requirements that protect the public.
Sure, makes sense.
However, the crucial difference in the macaroni case came down to the purpose and effect of the NMMA's agreement, especially when you combine that with their significant market power.
Right, the 70%.
Exactly. When dominant players in a market collude to control the inputs of their products with the clear intention and the likely outcome of distorting prices, that's when it crosses the line into an antitrust violation.
And that 70% market share we talked about right at the beginning really underscores that point, doesn't it? Their collective decision had a much, much bigger potential impact on the durum wheat market than if it were just, you know, a handful of small independent producers making a similar choice.
Absolutely. The NMMA's control over such a substantial portion of the market amplified the reach and the potential harm of their agreement on the durum wheat market. It gave their collective decision the power to significantly influence prices, making it particularly problematic from an antitrust perspective. It wasn't just seen as a market adjustment. It looked like a coordinated effort by major players to leverage their collective buying power.
There's a really key quote from the FTC that seems to encapsulate this perfectly. Where all dominant firms combine to fix product composition to depress raw material prices, they violate antitrust law. It sounds like the court really latched onto that core idea that the ultimate design and result of the agreement determine its legality, almost regardless of their initial justification of, you know, just trying to cope with a shortage.
Exactly. The court essentially said that even if the initial motives weren't explicitly malicious, maybe they genuinely were just trying to manage the shortage. At first, the anti-competitive effect of their coordinated action to depress raw material prices couldn't be ignored. Good intentions don't automatically excuse anti-competitive outcomes in the eyes of antitrust law.
So what are the broader implications of this seemingly specific case about macaroni? Why should someone studying law today, even if they're not planning to specialize in antitrust, pay attention to a bunch of pasta makers from the 1960s? What's the enduring lesson here?
Well, this case holds some really vital lessons that extend far beyond the pasta aisle. Firstly, it powerfully demonstrates that antitrust law isn't solely focused on the final price consumers pay. It's fundamentally concerned with protecting the entire market process and ensuring fair competition at all levels. Collusion at the input level, like manipulating the demand and therefore the price of raw materials, can be just as damaging potentially as price fixing the finished product, even if it might lead to temporarily lower prices for consumers sometimes.
Interesting.
The principle of a fair and competitive market for everyone involved is really paramount.
That's a really key takeaway. It's not just about whether prices go up or down at the checkout. It's about maintaining a competitive and healthy market ecosystem, you know, from the farm to the table.
Exactly. And secondly, this case serves as a critical cautionary tale for trade associations and other industry groups. While collaboration within these associations can be perfectly legitimate, even highly beneficial in many ways.
Like setting best practices, R&D.
Right. Promoting research, forming buying cooperatives to get efficiencies, all that can be fine. But they have to be incredibly vigilant not to engage in any activities that could ultimately impact prices or output in a way that harms overall competition. The line between legitimate cooperation and illegal collusion can be, well, surprisingly fine sometimes.
It sounds like there's a constant tightrope walk for these kinds of industry organizations.
Precisely. And for law students, as you mentioned, this case offers a really clear and relatively straightforward example of how courts analyze the crucial difference between the stated intent behind an action and its likely economic effect in antitrust cases.
Right.
The FTC didn't necessarily need to provide irrefutable proof that durum wheat prices actually plummeted directly because of this agreement. What they needed to demonstrate, and what the court ultimately agreed with, was that the agreement was designed to manipulate those prices and had the potential to do so.
That FTC statement again, price fixing is conclusively presumed unreasonable. That's so powerful. And the court adding that motives are irrelevant, the design and result determine illegality, really hammers that point home, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
It's all about the impact on the market, not necessarily what was in someone's heart when they made the agreement.
Exactly. It underscores the very strict stance that antitrust law takes against any agreement that has both the purpose and the likely effect of interfering with the free market's fundamental ability to determine prices through, you know, supply and demand.
So as we bring this deep dive to a close, what's the single most important lesson that sticks with you from the National Macaroni Manufacturers Association v. FTC case? What's the key insight for our listeners?
I think the core lesson is that antitrust scrutiny doesn't stop at the price tag of the final product. It extends to the often less visible but equally important realm of input markets and the potential for coordinated actions by dominant players to manipulate those markets. Even something as seemingly benign as agreeing on a standard product composition can raise significant antitrust red flags if it's undertaken by those with substantial market power, with the aim and foreseeable outcome of distorting prices for raw materials.
It really makes you think about how this fundamental principle might apply in various industries today, doesn't it? Where you see significant standardization of products or collective agreements on the inputs of production.
Yeah.
What are the potential hidden antitrust risks in those situations? Even if the initial justifications for collaboration appear perfectly reasonable or efficient, it encourages a much deeper level of analysis.
Absolutely. This case really encourages a more nuanced understanding of how market forces and competition are protected throughout the entire supply chain, not just at the point where consumers make a purchase. It highlights that maintaining a competitive market for everyone involved, from the initial producers of raw materials all the way to the end consumers, is a central and enduring goal of antitrust law.
Well, this has certainly given me a whole new perspective on what goes into that seemingly simple bowl of macaroni on my dinner table. Thanks so much for taking this deep dive with me.
My pleasure.
And to our listeners, we hope this has given you some serious food for thought.
Indeed. Until our next deep dive, keep exploring the fascinating and often unexpected intersections of law and everyday life.